All right, good morning. Yes, we're almost at the end of our Bible study, and we are getting to a point that is... Well, I just asked Sarah to please pray for me that I make it through today, so you guys can do that too. This was a wonderfully rich time of my own time to be able to study this chapter, so I'm glad to be able to bring it to you. We are starting today with verse 27, coming to the essential part of why Jesus came to this earth for us, and I am going to start with a side issue, a little bit out of order, that I know Maureen briefly touched on last week. But let's look at Judas, who remains an enigmatic, pivotal figure in the events leading to Jesus' death. You want me to turn it up? All right, I can do that. Okay, is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, good. We're going to start with Judas. There. How's that? Scholars and theologians over the years have tried to figure out why Judas betrayed his friend. Was he a zealot trying to push Jesus to act as a military savior in order to establish a nation independent of Rome? Was he a devoted follower who suddenly decided he didn't agree with anything that Jesus had taught? Was he greedy? Was he frightened? Was he all of the above? Could Matthew really not explain it himself, even though he had known Judas for 3 years? He does know that Judas's actions and death fulfilled prophecy about how Jesus would be betrayed, even if Jesus reminds us in Matthew 26:24 that Judas was still personally responsible for his own actions. God's purpose would not be changed. God's purpose would not be undone by Judas's deeds. And we know that Jesus' death was not unforeseen, nor was it accidental. So did Judas go to the Sanhedrin for spiritual guidance? And by the way, I'm not going to read it to make sure that we can get out of here before 10 o'clock, so you can get to your small group. So please follow along in your Bibles. The members of the Sanhedrin, who had broken God's law by paying witnesses to testify about Jesus, now say that they can't break their own rules by saying they can't take the money back from Judas. They are faced with a broken man. He's sorrowful and he's regretful, and they brush him off. Notice that I say regretful, but because he's clearly not repenting. If he was repenting, he would have tried to contact Jesus, not the Sanhedrin. In other words, Judas did take responsibility for his actions, but he did not change the attitude of his heart. He throws the coins into the temple. We don't exactly know where in the temple. He could not have thrown it into the Holy of Holies because he would not be allowed to approach that, but he throws it somewhere in the temple. He's not doing this as an act of piety, but he is doing it as an act of repudiation. Perhaps he was angry against God, and maybe he was afraid of God. And in his last act of anger and fear, he takes his own life. If you are worried about the differences between Matthew 27 and Acts 1, where Judas's suicide is described again, these so-called contradictions are very easily explained. Judas is said to have bought the field where he died in Acts. Well, clearly in Matthew, that means that the money that was his was used to buy the field. As Matthew, as I said, is describing that in more detail. Matthew simply describes his death by hanging, and the author of Acts describes it in more gruesome detail, the after effects of the hanging. So let's move back to the chronological procession now that we've got kind of gotten Judas taken care of, I think, as much as we can. Through the night, as we read in Matthew 26, Jesus had been on trial before the Sanhedrin. But that body must wait till daybreak in order to render its verdict. Again, they're trying to trying to thread the needle between God's law and their own rules, and it's against their custom to even have trials on the evenings of festivals. It's against their custom to have a trial by night. God's law says you're supposed to have all trials by day. It's supposed to be an open event where judgment is rendered in the light of day, and again, they're trying to pretend that they are doing things under God's law by waiting till daybreak to have this verdict. They do render the verdict quickly, although in Luke 23, 50 and 51, we are told that there was at least one dissenter, at least one person in the Sanhedrin who said this is not right. Since they cannot put Jesus to death, in John 18:31, the Jews actually remind Pilate of this, but perhaps also because they have brought Jesus up on charges that they know would interest Pilate, they decide that to bring him to Pilate. Pontius Pilate was a prefect, or a military governor, of the Roman territory of Judea. Now, technically, this area was under the supervision of the governor of Syria, but there had been enough disturbances in the area that the Romans appointed a special military governor in that area. By the time he had met Jesus, Pilate had been a prefect for about 10 years, which is a longer term than most. Usually they serve for 5 to 7 years. We do know him from an inscription in the city of Caesarea on the coast of Israel, and this is where he would have spent most of his time. It was where he had his headquarters, basically. He was in Jerusalem during the Passover, making sure there were no disturbances to the peace. And since it's unlikely that he had a palace here, as I said, he spent most of his time in another city. He probably would not have had a palace here at all. He may have stayed in a wing of Herod Antipas's palace. And so if you start reading the chronology of how Jesus is being tried, you'll notice that he's being sent to Pilate, then he goes to Antipas, and then he comes back to Pilate. And you might think, gee, that takes a lot of time to shuttle him across the city. He's probably just changing wings of a building. So it can happen in a fairly compressed amount of time. Pilate's detachment of soldiers, which were only part of a legion, the larger army was held in Syria by the governor, who was, as I said, his boss. They were probably housed in a barracks that we think we know was quite near to the temple, and that way they could oversee what was happening in the temple area. We also know a little bit about Pontius Pilate from Roman sources. He was from an equestrian family. That is, he was a nobleman, but he wasn't the highest rank of nobles. He was known by the Romans as well as the Jews as being a harsh ruler who didn't flinch at putting to death either his Jewish or his Samaritan subjects. His previous acts showed him to be a man who acted in haste, but who would back down in the face of strong Jewish opposition. In fact, he was so harsh as a governor that his boss, the governor of Syria, ordered him to return to Rome and answer for his actions in 37 AD, and he was supposed to explain himself before the Roman emperor. Luckily for Pilate, while he was on the boat from Caesarea to Rome, the emperor died, and so he was not brought up on charges, as far as we know. We are told, though, by a later Christian author that he was forced to commit suicide in 39 by the emperor Caligula, which does have the ring of truth to it, because Caligula would be very interested in his money, and so he was having people commit suicide that way. And Pilate clearly had no friends in Rome. While the Gospel of John relates in more detail the discussion between Jesus and Pilate, and by the way, we don't exactly know who supplied the Christians with this information. It may have been one of the bodyguard who witnessed witnessed these events. We know that at least one soldier marveled at Jesus' death and accepted that Jesus was the Son of God, and he may have been standing there and able to tell people later what happened. It may have been a member of the Sanhedrin, since we know that the gospel writer John was connected closely to a member of the Sanhedrin, and it may have been that he got information that way. Or it may have been from Jesus himself when he was on earth and teaching people after his resurrection. He may have told them what was happening. Anyway, so if you find in your commentator kind of a dismissal of how can the Christians have known about that, well, I think there's some really good alternatives to how they could have known. But Matthew is very brief. He condenses this discussion between Jesus and Pilate. Pilate is interested in only one thing. Are you the King of the Jews? This is a political title that the Roman Senate had given to the late Herod the Great. And all four Gospels tell us this is how Pilate began his questioning of Jesus. To Pilate, this is the most important question because it's a matter of treason to the state. And if the answer is positive, Jesus would be sentenced to death. Jesus gives an affirmative to Pilate's questioning by emphasizing you. You could translate it, you, even you yourself, say this. The answer he had already given this answer to the religious authorities, and now he's giving the same answer to the secular authority. Now notice that Jesus does not answer the chief priests and the elders anymore. They are continuing to bring accusations against him in front of Pilate. He's done with them. This, by the way, the body who is accusing him here cannot be the entire Sanhedrin. They probably would not fit into a space in the palace. It's probably a select body of the Sanhedrin. And we are told by John that this select body would not enter into the palace where Pilate was because it was unclean. They want to get Jesus condemned to death, and then they want to go celebrate the Passover in ritual purity. And this is a personal note. The layers of the story here get very intense, and every time I read this, it just, you know, God just reveals more. I grieve for these men who were so stuck in what they personally believe that they think they will be celebrating the Passover when the true and final Passover was happening right in front of their eyes. I grieve for them because I too can be so stuck in what I think I'm doing that's right that I can miss God's work in the world. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I just marvel at the complexity of this story, knowing that God knew how everything was going to play out even before he created the earth. And as I meditate on what it means, the more is revealed to me about the love that God has for us and his perfect solution to our sin and our separation from him. So Pilate listens to these accusations of the Sanhedrin, and he's surprised that Jesus makes no effort to defend himself. Do you hear, he says, how many or how great the accusations against you are? There's no Fifth Amendment in the Roman system. If the accused stays silent, that's an admission of guilt. Why does Matthew relate that Jesus refuses to answer the charges? Well, John tells us that, as I said, that he does engage with Pilate in a manner that Pilate could understand. They have a discussion about truth. But he is not going to address the charges against him because he knows that Pilate doesn't care about him and doesn't care about his teaching. So then we have the story of Barabbas, which again has caused some difficulty among commentators, because the story is, of course, that Pilate says to everyone, I will release a prisoner for you because it's festival time. Which one do you want? We don't hear about this custom of releasing a prisoner during the festival happening at any other time. It could be that it was a gesture of goodwill on Pilate's part. He may have been trying to gauge how in sync the Sanhedrin was with the people of Jerusalem, so he's going to actually test them. I don't really know the answer to why he is choosing to do this right now, except that I think it's part of God's story. Another problem is that Barabbas is not a real name. It's an alias. It means son of a father, something like, John Smith. I'm not saying that this episode never happened. I am saying that there are parts of the story about Jesus that may only be revealed at its proper times, which is not today. And I will remind you that up until 1954, that people could say that they did not think that Pilate was ever a prefect in Jerusalem, and then in that year, an inscription was found in Caesarea that named Pontius Pilate as prefect. So, you know, things take time to be revealed. God has just decided when to reveal stuff. What this story does show is that Jesus is now abandoned by everyone. His disciples have fled. Judas has betrayed him. Peter has disowned him. The Sanhedrin has voted for his death. The Roman authorities are not interested in saving his life. And now the crowd, and again, the crowd may have been brought in by the Sanhedrin, but they are clearly not part of the Sanhedrin. They're shouting for his death on a cross. And they are shouting for his death by, remember, a Roman manner of putting criminals to death. Barabbas, son of a father, every man, the symbol of each one of us, is guilty of sin. But he lives because Jesus has stepped in and taken his punishment. Instead of the rebel, Jesus dies. Then we have an odd little story. Sorry, technology is not catching up with me here. Then we have an odd little story of Pilate's wife, whose name we don't know. This is the only time we actually ever hear about her in history. Well, she comes to Pilate and says, "Have nothing to do with that man. I had a dream about him." The male head of the household in the Roman tradition was to interpret the dreams of his family because he's the priest of the household. And the tradition is, in fact, that if you have a, no, not every dream, but when you have a particularly vivid dream, you would go to the father, the head of the household, before anything else happened during that day and said, "I've had this dream. Please interpret it for me." So here everything is topsy-turvy because the wife has interpreted the dream and then sends word to the husband of how he should act. I suspect it took very little persuasion on the part of the chief priest to get Pilate to ignore this message, as any self-respecting Roman male would have done. However, it is something that Matthew wants to relate in order to show us that a Gentile hears the voice of God and knows that the legal proceedings are a sham, just as there had been one, at least one Jewish dissenter who knew the exact same thing. So then let's move to verses 24 and 25, which have been used and misused by some Christians throughout history to exonerate the Roman governor and to pass judgment on all Jews. Pilate has apparently been swayed by people reminding him that he could lose his legal status as friend of Caesar. It was a particular status that the emperor could give you, and it would give you certain legal rights. He could have taken Jesus back to Caesarea to stand trial. Remember, that's what happened later to Paul. He could have allowed the Sanhedrin to punish Jesus. Jesus was not a Roman citizen, so he could not appeal to Caesar, as Paul could. But Jesus is a nobody in Pilate's eyes. His action of washing his hands fits the pattern of Pilate's personality. He tries to dodge all responsibility, first by sending Jesus to Herod in Luke 23:7, by trying to have him returned to Jewish authority in John 19:4, by arguing with the crowd, by seeing if he can have the crowd call for the release of Jesus, and then by having Jesus whipped. But he gains nothing by it, because he could have released Jesus at any point, and he chose not to. Pilate's personality is here confirmed by other events, as I mentioned, that happened during his governorship. He may wash his hands, but this is still his decision. Similarly, the crowd that roars for Jesus' death, they have no authority to pass their personal sin on to their descendants. Although some Christians have taught that from this verse, this is why all Jews are condemned and cursed. But Matthew, again, is showing us something important here. God has allowed these trials to take place to show us that Jesus was condemned by all earthly authorities and all secular authorities. both religious and secular authorities. And now, because he carries our sin, the Father has to turn his face away. Jesus is alone, bearing your and my sin. We now move on to the story of Jesus' punishment and crucifixion. I want you to note that unlike many artists and storytellers from the medieval period to up until today, Matthew is quite brief about the physical suffering of Jesus, although he knows it was intense and horrific. More important to Matthew is the message of the meaning of Christ's sufferings. We do know about crucifixion in the ancient world, specifically from a lawyer named Cicero. He was also a politician. He lived about a generation before Jesus. And this is just one of many things we hear about it. But anyway, in one of his prosecutions, he brings charges against a governor who illegally crucified a Roman citizen. Cicero calls this punishment torture, shameful, incredibly painful, and something that's only appropriate for slaves. We know that after Jesus' death, many Christians and many Jews were crucified for treason. We also know that for hundreds of years after Jesus' death, Christians refused to make an image of his death, probably since even the memory of that physical act of crucifixion was so painful. So Matthew gives us the bare bones of the story, the scourging, which is probably a normal part of the process, but here made especially painful by the Roman soldiers who mock him. They have heard about the charges that Jesus has been brought up on, and they are contemptuous of this lone Jew who is now in their custody. They do not understand that Jesus is indeed the King of the Jews, and even their own true king. They dress him in an old reddish-purple cloak that soldiers were issued. They give him a crown of thorns and a reed for a scepter. We don't exactly know where this mocking and whipping would have taken place. May have taken place in the Roman barracks, but as I said, we don't really know. We don't know how many men were involved, but it is likely that at least some of them became the guard who stood at the foot of the cross and then gambled for his clothes. Jesus is taken outside of the city, as is customary, to be crucified. In the procession to the place that is called Golgotha, Jesus is very, very likely passed near the terrace of the temple and very likely could have heard the songs of the priests as they were singing while they slaughtered the lambs for Passover. This must have been an agonizing moment to hear the priests singing about how God had saved his people from slavery and death, while the true firstborn was heading for his own death to permanently save all of God's people from the slavery of sin and our punishment by death. Other moments from this procession, we suspect that Simon of Cyrene became an important witness in the early church, and so he is mentioned here. We know very little about him, except that he came from Cyrene, which is in North Africa. It's actually in Libya. By mentioning Simon, Matthew is telling us that Jesus' death was important to everyone on earth, not just the people in Jerusalem. Matthew moves on to the dividing of the clothing, which he makes sure to tell you was predicted by King David almost 1,000 years before his death in Psalm 22:18. Matthew also reminds us that David in Psalm 69:21 had predicted that Jesus would be given wine and gall, or wine and myrrh. This is a drink that has some pain-deadening qualities to it, which is why Jesus refuses to drink it. He is instead drinking the full cup of the Father's wrath for us, not the world's version of avoiding pain. Matthew continues to show us how Jesus' death and purpose for his death had been discussed by the prophets over the years, reminding us in Isaiah 53:12, he was numbered among the transgressors, not only by being accused of treason, but by dying next to convicted criminals. And in the mocking of the bystanders in Psalm 22:7, Psalm 69:9, and Lamentations 1:12. The mockers are committing blasphemy. They clearly understood that Jesus taught that he was the Son of God. And you'll notice that when they say, if you are the Son of God, do X. Notice this was the exact same blasphemy that Satan had said to Jesus in Matthew 4:6. If you're the Son of God, do this. In this mocking, we see that Jesus is completely rejected by the chief priests, the scribes, all the way down to the crowd. He is abandoned by all but one disciple, his mother, although it is heartening to hear that many of his female followers were standing there. These women especially are singled out by Matthew in verse 55 as a beacon of courage in this dark hour. The mockers offer a more profound truth than even the mocking title above his head. He was the King of the Jews, and it is the power of his will that keeps him on the cross to save us, when he could have easily called down 12 legions of angels to get himself off of this torture device. Mm-hmm. We don't know how long Jesus was on the cross before the supernatural darkness descended on Jerusalem. Matthew implies it was actually fairly quickly, and we are told that it lasts from noon until about 3 p.m. Commentators point out that this darkness is like the darkness that descended on Egypt. This was the last plague before the killing of the firstborn. Darkness is often associated with judgment. You can check out Amos 8:9 and Revelation 16:10. Jesus' dying words are a mixture of Hebrew and Aramaic, although he's consciously quoting Psalm 22. And since he is calling out in a loud voice, it seems to me that even with his dying breath, he is teaching the onlookers, trying to remind them about the suffering servant, about messianic prophecy, and acknowledging that the Father has seen the price paid for our sins. As Paul says in Galatians 3:13, but Christ has rescued us from the curse pronounced by the law. When he was hung on the cross, he took upon himself the curse for our wrongdoing. That's in the New Living Translation. Some onlookers waited for the appearance of Elijah to help Jesus. Elijah, the Jews remembered, had not died, but had ascended to heaven in a chariot. So Jews of this time considered him a figure who could perform miracles. He also, however, was to usher in the age of the Messiah, as we heard at the beginning of Matthew's Gospel. So they seem to be kind of, you know, thinking now, what's going on here? Jesus' last words are recorded in John 19:30, it is finished. His death was a voluntary giving up of his spirit. It is not a normal death in any way. And we hear in John 19:32 that no one expected his death to come so soon. This not normal death was marked by several miraculous signs. The curtain of the Holy of Holies was torn in two, permanently breaking the barrier between God and his created. The earth quakes to let the Gentiles too know that the ground underneath their feet, which had seemed so permanent, had just moved because of the death of the Son of God. This earthquake convinced the Gentile centurion and the legionaries that they had seen the death of the Son of God, and they are some of the first Gentiles of the harvest. And in a foretaste of Jesus' death, meaning the end of death itself, holy people were raised to life and bore witness to the event. It says after the resurrection, it says they walked around the city of Jerusalem. Now that Jesus is dead, he has to be buried before sunset, as the chief priests and scribes tell Pilate in John 19:31. Joseph, a member of the Sanhedrin, was wealthy enough to have a new and never used rock-cut tomb in Jerusalem, and he wants to honor Jesus by putting his body in his own family tomb. Since Jesus' family was poor, could never afford a tomb like this, and does not come from Jerusalem anyway. They would not have a family tomb here. This is an extraordinary gesture, especially for a man who had been executed for treason and blasphemy. And by Jewish law, Joseph could never have used that tomb again for another burial. The criminals who were killed beside Jesus were probably buried in a mass grave, as should have happened to Jesus. However, we know that his burial in this rock-cut tomb was predicted by the prophet Isaiah 700 years before he died. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death. 53:9. Joseph also goes on to great lengths to honor Jesus by wrapping him in clean linen. That is, he had taken linen that has never been used before, and wrapping the body in it. Again, he's just giving everything that he has. He spared no expense. And then, in a customary manner, a rock is rolled into position for a door. Now, the rocks for these tombs were taller than a person. They look like an old-fashioned millstone that are balanced up on one end and fitted into a slot in the ground. It takes more than one person to put a piece of wood in a slot in the rock and roll it into position. It would also need more than one person to roll it back when the family wanted to reuse the tomb, which was quite normal. I love that Matthew tells us that the women who normally would have prepared the body for burial, men never prepared bodies for burial, but here's Joseph of Arimathea doing it himself. And by the way, that makes him ritually unclean. He cannot celebrate the Passover now. He's unclean for 7 days. The women who had prepared his body for burial are instead witnesses to the place where Jesus' body was taken. There would be no confusion in their minds when they come back in 3 days to properly prepare the body. They knew exactly where to go to look for him. It's only on the next day, interestingly, that the chief priests and the Pharisees, and note, the Sanhedrin is now out of this. It seems that they have kind of withdrawn from the conflict. They think Jesus is dead. Remember, they don't believe in resurrection. So they've withdrawn from the conflict. But the chief priests and the Pharisees come to Pilate, and they ask that there be a guard of Jewish soldiers to be posted outside the tomb to make sure that no one would steal the body and then lie about the resurrection. They were worried the disciples would do this. So what is interesting here is that Jesus' teaching about his own resurrection was not clear to the disciples, but the chief priests and the Pharisees understood something about his teaching. They say this last deception will be worse than his first deception. We're not entirely sure what the first deception was. It might have been this first deception was getting people to think that he was the Messiah. So now we settle down to wait for the end of this story, which had been told to the Jewish people many years before by the prophets and repeated during the 3 years that Jesus had taught. Ironically, the precautions taken by both the religious and the secular authorities ensure that there is an ironclad alibi against the story that the disciples stole the body and pretended that Jesus rose from the dead. So we wait, knowing that on the third day, the tomb was empty. We are each faced with this question: how did this come about? So let's pray before I send you off into your groups. Our Father in heaven, we still tremble every time we read or we hear about this marvelous story, this work that you planned from the beginning, before you even created man. May our joy that Jesus loved us so much that he came to earth and died for us be mixed with great sorrow that it was our sin that compelled him to do that. My prayer is that each woman here has faced the fact of the empty tomb and has begun to understand the height and the depth and the breadth of God's love for her. Amen. Careful, careful.